it's not.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here Monday morning. We have a number of bills that we have set up for work sessions. There's a couple of them that were carried over from last Thursday. I'm going to go ahead and start with the work session since we did carry those over, and I think we can get through most of those pretty quick. Why don't we go ahead and start with Senate Bill 941, since that's why most of the people are probably here, so we'll open up the work session on 941. Jeff, why don't you just give us an overview of where we're at?
Certainly, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 941 comes to us from Senators Przanski and Burdick, as well as Representatives Williamson and Hoyle. This bill requires all private transferors of firearms to appear at a gun dealer in person with both the transferee and the firearm and request a criminal background check before the transfer. The bill enumerates exceptions for family members, law enforcement, inherited firearms, and certain temporary transfers. It states that a violation of the background check law constitutes a Class A misdemeanor for the first offense and a Class C felony for a second and subsequent offense. It directs the Department of State Police to notify local law enforcement when a background check demonstrates that the transferee is prohibited from possession of a firearm, and allows the court to prohibit a person participating in outpatient treatment from possession of a firearm during the period of treatment upon certain findings. We do have a number of amendments before us. We have proposed Dash 2, which create exemptions for transfer of a firearm to a law enforcement officer, a Dash 3, which creates an exemption for transfer of a firearm to a person with a valid concealed carry permit, a proposed Dash 4, which creates an exemption for a person who is an active duty service member in the Armed Forces of the United States. The proposed Dash 7 amendments provide that if a transferor and transferee live over 40 miles from one another, the transferor may ship or deliver the firearm to a gun dealer located near the transferee. It makes the Department of State Police reporting of a failed attempt, attempted failed transfer to the sheriff a permissive requirement. The proposed Dash 8 amendments direct the Department of Transportation to create a specific license which notes a person is a convicted felon. And finally, the proposed Dash 11 amendments remove all substantive portions of the bill and state that a transferor who completes a criminal background check is immune from criminal liability for selling a firearm to a prohibited person and enumerates persons prohibited from possession of a firearm.
All right. Well, thank you for the review. I think what I want to do is just start off where we left off last Thursday. If you remember, we had this scheduled for a work session, and prior to getting to the point of working it, Senator Thatcher passed me a note stating that she had an amendment, which is the Dash 8s, that she was proposing and wanting to go forward. They had been posted with the judiciary staff approximately, if I've got the, if I remember correctly, 8:48, 8:50, something like that in the morning. As most of you realize, we have a one-hour rule that requires amendments to be on the table and public for at least 1 hour prior to them being discussed. Because of commitments that Senator Cruz had, as well as the lateness in time of when we could take up the Dash 8s, I chose to carry the work session over till today. And since then, I understand, Senator Thatcher, you have, I guess, somewhat, I'm going to say, formally or tried to retract the Dash 8s?
It was appearing that the Dash 8s were becoming complicated to get right in this short period of time. And so I had a replacement suggestion, and that was the Dash 11s.
All right, so the Dash 8s would have basically, from what I've read, would have done what I call the scarlet letter, would have placed a notation on people's driver's license or on their ID that they were felons. What were the other issues that you saw that I'm just curious, because that's something that we kind of left on, and I think it's important to set the record straight as to why you chose to remove those, because that was the reason that we actually carried this over till today.
Well, the goal would be to make it not just felons, but any prohibited person. It would be marked on their driver's license, and it didn't get drafted exactly right there, but as we were trying to work through the drafting of it, and I don't know if Jessica's nearby, but as she was drafting it, there were a number of other questions, and how to address those were becoming sort of cumbersome, especially for the agencies. And I know it would be very expensive for the Department of Motor Vehicles to go through with their current system, their computer system, and change the driver's license format and add a mark. Just that alone would have created a huge fiscal.
Yeah, I understand that from working with DMV on multiple different other issues. I know that they have that antiquated computer system that they always seem to not be able to update, which seems to always cause the large fiscal. So I'm also, I guess, was somewhat pleased to hear that you did decide to pull that off, because, as I said, this amendment to me would have been more of a scarlet letter, knowing that we have individuals that are attempting to reestablish themselves in society, having that type of a mark for applications for housing, for jobs, where we're trying to, let's say, ban the box. Seems like that would not have been in the focus that we've had. So,
and Mr. Chair, I would rather have gone with a more positive route and have it so that, I don't know. I would rather have gone a more positive route rather than marking with a negative. But
right.
it was difficult to figure that out in this short period of time. So the replacement suggestion was to just, instead of saying it's currently against the law, or actually it's, believe, a Class A misdemeanor to purposely or knowingly sell to a prohibited person. And I believe when that standard came into the statute that we didn't have the ability to do background checks. So the removal of the knowing element would improve that statute and give people the incentive to use the background check system.
So you're now referring to, I assume, was the Dash 11s?
Dash 11s, yes, sir.
Yeah, and I've looked at that as well, and it seems to me there's a strict liability per perspective there. And it's not that we don't have strict liability in our criminal laws, but that's one of those areas that we normally don't have as much. I looked at that, the Dash 11s. It does not have the tier approach. It seems like it has a single type of offense that stays the same. So if you have an offender who's multiple offending that continues to do it, that they would still be sanctioned with only a misdemeanor, not going up to a felony, which we have done on many other type of legislation and laws, where if the person doesn't learn the first time, the second time we have a little more stricter approach. The other part for the Dash 11s for the chair was lack of uniformity. It does appear from all indications from the background check that this state has had for 25 years, it does in fact work, and it works very well, allowing for the vast majority of individuals attempting to transfer guns to do so without any hindrance. And that's also, to me, much more efficient in ensuring that the goal, if you're trying to keep individuals that have been prohibited by law from having access to a firearm, and let alone easy access to a firearm, that the background check is important to require to be done. And like I said, for 25 years, it's worked well. We just need to close this loophole. So any more discussions on any of these? If not,
well, Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that the current law doesn't escalate penalties for knowingly selling a firearm to a prohibited person. That's the only change, was removing the knowing element. I wasn't changing the penalties, but we can discuss that. I'd be happy to.
I understand that. That's current law. That's why the current bill that's before us, 941, does in fact tier it, and then the Dash 7s actually puts into play what some of us realized was probably would have been an inconvenience, and that would be requiring individuals who live further than 40 miles apart to actually be in the same location as the buyer. And so the Dash 7s will in fact allow for individuals who have these transactions to do similar to what we understand happens with a internet sale, that the gun can be transferred to a licensed dealer either close to or at the request location of the buyer, and then the buyer would complete the transaction by going through the background check prior to having the weapon exchanged to him or her. So, Senator Burdick, I'm wondering if you would be so kind to give us a motion on the dash sevens.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven amendments to Senate Bill 941.
Senator Burdick moves the dash sevens amendments in the Senate Bill 941. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Senator Burdick?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 941 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 941 as amended by the dash sevens to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will be voting no on the bill.
All right. Any other discussion or comments? Objections? Let the record reflect that Senator Cruz and Senator Thatcher are objecting. There are still three votes in the affirmative. Motion carries, and the bill will be on its way to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I would like to serve notice of the potential minority report.
Senator Cruz gives notice of a potential minority report. He understands what the guidelines are, and they'll let us know if that happens or doesn't. Thank you for the notice. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the work session. The chair will be the carrier of the bill. And let's go ahead and work through. You want to start at the top of the work sessions? I figured we'd get those out of the way. All right, we're going up to the top of the work session, Senate Bill 379. We'll open up that work session.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 379 on March 18th. This is the Oregon Law Commission's probate modernization bill. It deals with intestacy and wills. You have the proposed dash 3 amendments before you, and it has no revenue, a minimal fiscal impact, and is ready to go.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendment. Excuse me. To Senate Bill 379.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 379. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 379 as amended by the dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz now moves Senate Bill 379 as amended by the dash 3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. And let's see what we got here.
I think you ought to carry.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. Chair will carry 379. Well, wait. I think Senator Gelser really wants it.
Desperately.
He'll stay with the chair. Okay. He's quick. All right, we're open up. I guess if we need to close the work session on 379, open a work session on 384, and let's see, this is
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 384. We heard this bill on February 10th at a public hearing. This bill would require court-appointed court reporters in aggravated murder trial proceedings. There is one amendment, the dash one amendment before the committee. This simply modifies the language of the bill so that court reporters is consistent with other areas of Oregon law. There is a fiscal impact, so we would need to add a referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. All right. So this one is going to be going to Ways and Means, and we do need the dash ones, please.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 384.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 384. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 384 as amended by the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the bill be subsequently referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 384 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but with a subsequent with a request for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means based on its having a fiscal impact. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on, we modified language regarding court reporters to be consistent with another statute, but are we looking at, I guess I would rather look at the outcome rather than the process of getting there, and court reporters might be the way to do it now that meet a certain definition and outcome. But there might be other technologies and other ways of getting there later. And does this preclude that from happening?
We'll have to ask staff, because I don't remember how that was defined. My understanding, though, I believe it was calling for a individual live reporter, if I remember correctly.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, that is correct. There is currently under ORS 8.415 to 8.455 definitions of court reporters, referring to the live in-person court reporter, and that's what this bill and the amendment aims at.
So would, I guess, a live court reporter doing the, you know, whatever that machine is, would that preclude them from doing some sort of recording device and being in charge of making sure the recordings are happening correctly, or using technology in, different from the normal court reporting technology? Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. And my understanding, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, is that court reporting, by definition, is when someone is in court listening and transcribing as the events are happening in front of them in real time.
Mr. Chair, I don't think this would preclude the ability for a recording device as well, if the court wanted it.
Yeah, as a backup?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do believe the way it's currently written, and Senator Thatcher, since you haven't had the opportunity on the House side to sit through judiciary, this has been a perpetual ongoing
one
bill.
Of those.
So what I'm going to be putting on the record, and I'll go ahead and do it now, we have accommodated attempting to move this forward numerous times. It goes down to Ways and Means where it has not been funded. And I'm telling the world, if it doesn't happen this time, we'll be really thinking twice as to whether we continue to try to move this piece of legislation, the policy, forward. I agree with the policy. I think it's important. I'd rather see us have the assurance of having a transcript that could be made and a record made, that you don't have to have these trials start all over. I mean, the impact on the victims alone, to have to go through the trauma of multiple trials and having one being required because the court reporting was not accomplished. But at the same time, I'm not sure how we get the message down to Ways and Means of the importance. Now, I've been told they're going to seriously look at it, but if it doesn't happen, I think we as a committee this next time, we're going to have to look at what are different alternatives than what we have proposed today.
If I could, Mr. Chair, we're talking about a very small universe here.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that needs to be stressed, that this is a very small universe, and to a degree, this is transparency in that process. So
it is. And it's one of those things that, I mean, again, it's for us to have to think of the impact on just the system to have to go through a trial just financially, let alone the emotional toll that it takes on everyone that is a participant, and then realizing that you have to start all over again just isn't right. And the cost to me is far outweighed by having a system that works.
The human cost.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. Any other questions or comments? All right. So we do have a motion as to the adoption of the dash ones for Senate Bill 384. Any objection?
No, we already did that. The motion now is to send it to Ways and Means.
Oh, it is. I apologize. I got caught up in the conversation. So at this point, is there any objection to the motion, which would be basically to forward it to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation? So ordered. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on 384. No carriers necessary since it's going to Ways and Means. We'll open up a work session on 622.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 622, Senator Gelser's bill. You heard this on March 2nd. It adds legislative staff to the list of mandatory reporters of abuse and extends criminal liability protection to those who make reports in good faith. In response to concerns from the committee and testimony we received, Senator Gelser developed the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 2s remove legislative staff and volunteers from mandatory reporter requirements, and the Dash 3s add home care workers, as defined by ORS 410.600, to the list of mandatory reporters of abuse. It is ready to move with the Dash 2 and 3.
All right, so.
And we've got all the paperwork and we're ready to go.
That, and the paperwork's all here?
Works here.
Mr. Chair, I move the, excuse me, move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 622.
Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments for Senate Bill 622. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 622.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 622. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 622 as amended by the dash two and dash three amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz now moves Senate Bill 622 as amended by the dash twos as well as the dash threes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Gosh, I wonder who'd want to carry this one.
Oh, let's see. I think the chair should probably carry this one.
Well, I would think.
Yeah. We'll let Senator Gelser, since she was so warm receiving the other one.
I know.
Energetic to carry this one instead.
Are you carrying the other one?
Yes. Yes, I am.
I didn't want to give Senator Gelser bad info here.
All right, so we're closed the work session on 622. And we're now open up a work session on Senate Bill 740.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 740 comes to you from Senator Shields on behalf of Disability Rights Oregon. You heard this on March 26th. This says that it is the responsibility of the arresting jurisdiction to pay the costs of an interpreter for a person who has a hearing impairment or speaking impairment when that person is arrested. It has a minimal fiscal, no amendments. It's ready to go.
All right. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
I suggest we have Senator Shields carry.
We will have Senator Shields carry. And so Senator Shields will be known as, or noted as the carrier for Senate Bill 740. We'll close the work session on 740 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 839.
Now, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 839 comes to this committee from Senators Cruz, Bates, Steiner, Hayward, and Representatives Williamson, Fagan, Peluso, Taylor, and Wilson. This is the Good Samaritan bill we had a public hearing on last Thursday, April 2nd. The bill grants immunities from arrest and prosecution for certain drug offenses when there is evidence obtained in response to a request for medical assistance. There is one amendment, the dash one amendment, that simply clarifies that the immunities apply to conduct that constitutes violations of Section 3 of the bill, which is the drug possessions, as well as it does not provide immunities from out-of-state warrants and federal warrants. There is a minimal fiscal, no revenue, and it's ready to move with the dash ones.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 839.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 839. Discussion?
So just to clarify, this creates an immunity for drug possession only when, is that?
Chair
Did I understand that correctly?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Thatcher, the immunity is for current charges would be listed in subsection 3. Most of those offenses are simple possession charges. Sub A is an offense frequenting a place where controlled substances are located. So that would also, you'd be immunized from that as well.
I see.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objections to the amendment, I guess,
I don't have any objections to the amendment. I just want to get some more information on the whole bill before I vote yes on it.
All right.
When it comes to that.
Let me move the amendment, then we have a little bit more discussion. So, is there any objection to the motion to move the dash ones into the bill itself, Senate Bill 839? Not seeing any. So ordered. So, why don't we go ahead and put the motion on, and then we can talk a little bit more.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 839 as amended by the Dash 1 Amendment to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 839 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. So let's open it up for discussion. Senator Thatcher?
Yeah, I just don't feel comfortable at this point voting yes. I might when it comes to the floor. I think we just heard it on the last committee day.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, so that's mostly my objection.
Yeah, my understanding, I don't know, Senator Cruz, you signed on to this. This is basically trying to ensure that if someone is in the process of having a drug overdose, that whoever's around them or the individual themselves are not, let's say, afraid to call for first responders, thinking that they're somehow going to now be facing some type of criminal charges, instead of ensuring that the person's life is, let's say, top priority.
Mr. Chair, actually, the person involved is already covered under current law, and that we did, I think, two sessions ago or maybe three. This basically would allow somebody who's with them to do the reporting without fear of prosecution for doing the reporting and getting the services to that person.
Okay. And I'm also understanding, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, the other part that it would immune is that the location of where this is occurring for someone that was, let's say, an eager beaver as a prosecutor from being able to, let's say, backdoor and charge somebody for being a place where illegal substances were used. And so that was the reason that they included that exemption as well.
That's correct, Senator Prezanski, that's correct. And the other thing the bill does is it immunizes folks up front from the prosecution, and also if someone is on some sort of supervision for a drug-related offense, it grants the same immunities that they can't be prosecuted for a probation violation or arrested on a probation violation.
Yeah, brought in on a show cause.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I think, and I'll put it on the record on the floor, but the program's actually working, and it's saving lives, and the interesting part is that the remedy for the overdose is not a pleasant thing to go through. And I think we're also finding some people that it's kind of a come-to-reality moment for them as well. So, in no way, shape, or form can this be construed as a soft-on-crime measure, in my opinion.
Well, I think it also kind of puts in perspective that in many of these cases, unfortunately, the individuals that are impacted by this are addicted to the whatever the substance is.
Yeah.
So that really moves it, from my perspective, into a health issue as much as a criminal. And so basically we're kind of prioritizing, as you've said previously, a person's life is valued greater than the criminal sanctions, and we shouldn't allow for people not to report based on a fear that they're going to somehow be caught up in the criminal justice system when someone's life depends on that report sooner than later. All right, so that's our discussion. So, Senator Thatcher, do you want us to put down at this point a reservation of a no with the right to change?
Yes, please.
All right, so Senator Thatcher is voting no, but with the reservation to change her vote after she gets additional information on the floor. Is there anyone else that has an opposition to the bill? All right, that would be the only opposition. The motion is passed. And on this one,
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates and I would like to co-carry. He will open, I'll close.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill, if I got that right. 839. It's going to move up. All right. And so that takes care of our work sessions, from my understanding. We'll go back up to the top. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 222A.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 222A. You'll see from the A that this has been somewhere before. So this came to us from the Senate Human Services Committee. This deals with juvenile dependency and the representation of the Department of Human Services by the Attorney General. It begins a rolling repeal of the current law, which authorizes the Department of Human Services to appear without the Attorney General in some specific situations. As a result, the Department of Human Services would be required to be represented by the Attorney General in all dependency proceedings by June 30th, 2018. We've been asked to send this bill down to Ways and Means because it has a fairly large fiscal impact. So I have a letter here for that. It has no revenue impact, though. So it is ready to go today, should you wish to do that.
All right, thank you. So what we're going to do is we're going to, I've got three people that at least at this point who want to give testimony. So all three of you, if you please come forward. Jerry Weybrandt, Joanne Southerly, I believe, and Mark McKechnie. While they're coming up, let me ask if there's anyone else here today who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 222A. So I'm going to let's see, who wants to start? I'm not sure.
Let's let the agency start first.
Okay.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, I'm Jerry Weybrandt. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 222A. I want to start by just mentioning that many of you are aware of child welfare. We have a mission around ensuring children and youth are safe, well, and connected to their families, communities, and cultural identities. As part of this effort, the department is regularly required to appear before juvenile dependency courts that oversee cases involving DHS. Juvenile dependency judges are responsible for making important decisions around custody, placement, parental rights, and other factors. This is a critical component of the child welfare system, and it holds the department and parents accountable to the best interests of children and youth we serve. For many years, in certain situations, child welfare workers have entered court alone. Many factors influence this, including budgetary and policy challenges and a developing juvenile dependency court system. At present, only in most juvenile dependency cases, parents are represented, children are represented, and DAs are present to carry the state, leaving child welfare workers as the only unrepresented party appearing before the court. Not having training or licensing as attorneys, they have been in a difficult place of needing to be responsive to the court, not going too far as to slip into behavior that would be construed as practicing law. With the passage and implementation of this plan before you, child welfare workers will enter the court with counsel. For the last year, the department has been in conversation with DOJ and OJD about the options available to achieve universal representation in the most cost-effective manner. We've explored regionalization, video appearance in uncontested matters in our more rural counties, consolidated docket days, and the use of special assistant attorney generals in limited cases as jointly determined by the AG and DHS. The plan before you would create a rolling implementation of full representation between 2015 and 2018. The department worked with DOJ and in consultation with OJD to identify the counties and their implementation schedule. Upon passage of this bill, we will achieve full representation for child welfare workers by 2018. We thank you for your time and ask your support in this bill.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Joanne Southey. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel of the Oregon Department of Justice Civil Enforcement Division. I'm also the attorney in charge of the Child Advocacy Section, who advises and provides litigation to support to the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. We're here today also in support of the Ayn Gross version of Senate Bill 222. As you heard from DHS, this bill addresses the need for Department of Human Services caseworkers to appear alongside counsel in juvenile dependency proceedings. This is required by law as set forth in ORS 9.320. In the 2014 session, this legislature passed House Bill 4156, which presented a temporary status quo fix to this issue, which was raised at that time. The provisions of that House Bill 4156 do sunset June 30th of this year, 2015. As of that point in time, it will be required that the agency is represented in court in all juvenile dependency proceedings. In order to minimize the fiscal impact to the state and to allow for a thoughtful, staged implementation of this bill, we determined several stages of implementation in which counties were identified in which we could do a rolling sunset of the House Bill 4156 and achieve ultimately full legal representation. As stated across the state, DHS child welfare workers do routinely appear without counsel. And while caseworkers can be strong advocates, of course, for their position, they are not legally trained and are not legally authorized to present evidence to the court to secure a good record and to move forward in ensuring that children achieve permanency in the quickest way possible. The DOJ, along with DHS and in consultation with the Oregon Judicial Department, have outlined the concerns, identified areas in which we could all improve and achieve efficiencies in this legal representation, including, as outlined, the implementation of several docket days in counties that do not have them currently, potential video appearance or telephonic appearance, if appropriate, in certain kinds of cases. The workers that appear without counsel at times are in a room where almost every other party, if not every party, is represented by counsel. This has a significant impact on delaying permanency for children. There are times where the worker is unable to proceed in a case without having counsel and therefore has to ask for continuance or has to ask to come back. Alternately, if there is a significant legal issue which is taken up on appeal, these cases wind through the system, our appellate courts, at an increased rate as opposed to other cases, but it still often results in delay of up to about a year for an appellate opinion to come down, which then would potentially require remanding that issue to the court to be heard again, with this time with legal counsel. And that has a significant impact on children in our system, not only for the delay in time, which would, you know, has a fiscal impact to the state, but also for these children that have to wait and whose permanency is delayed by not being able to know that their legal position has been secured. So DHS caseworkers are not legally trained, as stated. They cannot interpret the law. They often make decisions or receive information that has significant legal impact and are unable to proceed without that legal advice or attorney standing next to them. So we ask your support in this bill, and I'm also available to answer any questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Before we do questions, Mark, why don't you go ahead and give us your comments.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We've represented over 50,000 children and youth in the juvenile court system since 1975. We represent about 1,000 juvenile court clients at any given time. And I'm here today to talk about the need for a more comprehensive approach to the issue that being discussed this morning. The fact is that DHS has been routinely appearing at hearings without counsel for decades. This issue is not a new issue. It's come up as a question many times. I think what has brought us here today is that a few judges started raising the question about whether DHS could appear and whether their caseworkers were somehow practicing law by appearing without the Attorney General's office. And those questions were resolved in the last session through a bill that sunsets at the end of this session. The most expedient way to deal with this issue is to simply extend the sunset of that provision for two more years to give opportunity for more comprehensive look at the bigger issue. In addition to the question about practicing law, another important statute should be discussed. It's one that requires state agencies to be represented only by the Department of Justice. This limits the options for DHS in choosing different methods for having their needs for legal representation met. In the private sector, an enterprise as large as DHS and child welfare would normally develop the capacity of in-house counsel to represent them in their interests. Current statute prevents DHS from considering that option, nor would they have that option going forward if Senate Bill 222 passes. Frankly, the reason we're here today and the reason this issue hasn't been resolved in the past is the substantial cost of changing the status quo. According to the fiscal impact statement, the hourly charge by DOJ to DHS in the next biennium per hour for attorney representation will be $181. DOJ attorneys already receive substantially higher compensation, have more manageable caseloads, and significantly more administrative support than the attorneys representing other parties in these cases, namely parents and children. Well, it is accurate that once the cases are established and down the road, there are routine review hearings where the state appears without counsel and other parties are represented. That's not necessarily true at one of the most critical hearings, which is the very first hearing, the often referred to as the preliminary hearing or the shelter hearing, after a child has been removed from his or her parents and the court is determining whether there's probable cause that abuse or neglect occurred and whether DHS has made reasonable efforts to prevent removal. It's common in many counties for both parents and children as parties to the case to be unrepresented at that hearing, meaning there's little opportunity to question whether the facts being presented by DHS have substantial basis or whether the agency has made sufficient reasonable efforts to prevent removal. So there are clearly problems in not providing sufficient resources to legal representation for parents and children to provide full representation for them. And again, the substantial cost required by first, the requirement that state agencies be represented by the DOJ, and second, the method of payment on an hourly basis makes it a substantially more expensive prospect. Compared to my organization, the cost per attorney FTE for the DOJ is 84, almost 85% higher. That's because of compensation differences, workload differences, and the administrative support that the state agency enjoys compared to what private contractors receive. In addition, the argument made in favor of this bill is to put attorneys in the courtroom alongside the caseworkers that they represent. Yet if you look at the fiscal for the first biennium, the FTE paid for that would be required under this bill, only 31.7% of the FTE are for attorney positions. That means more than two-thirds are for other staff positions and overhead. So if our goal is to put attorneys in the courtroom, again, I question this approach in achieving that goal. I'm still trying to collect accurate information, and I understand that this discussion will carry on most likely in the Ways and Means Committee. But it appears to me that the additional cost of this proposal, once fully implemented, the additional cost on top of current expenses will be nearly the entire amount that's currently spent on legal representation for parents and children combined. So we're talking about legal representation for one party, a state agency, costing nearly as much as the combined cost for all the other parties in the case, which are often at least three other parties, at least one child, and two parents. Sometimes there are more. So we would prefer that there be a larger conversation around this issue to look at the resources available to make sure that these cases are handled appropriately. We agree that good and complete representation for DHS is part of that need, but it is not the whole story. And we would prefer that an approach look at all needs in the system. There was a work group during the interim that looked at that and came up with a bill in the House side to implement in stages, providing resources to all parts of the system in a phased-in approach. We think that's a more appropriate approach to address this issue. And frankly, we're somewhat concerned that this particular proposal was not discussed in that process when all of the stakeholders were available and engaged, and that this particular proposal came up rather late without a lot of time to respond. And I'm glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Senator Pelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious why the depth of these concerns weren't brought up in the other committee. We spent a great deal of time work grouping this beginning the first week of session, and we didn't hear from you until the day of the hearing, and the concerns weren't stated nearly as strongly at that hearing as they were today. Has something happened between then and now, and is there a reason you didn't ask or offer to be part of the work that was taking place between DHS, the Judicial Department, and the AG's office?
Chair Prozonsky, Senator Gelser, I reached out to the DHS representative, I believe the second day of session, with questions about this bill, and I was simply told that amendments were being worked on and that they would be provided later. I had no indication of the direction that the amendments were going. I looked at the bill at face value. It extended the sunset on the legislation that was passed in 2004. To the best of my knowledge, that was the approach taken. There was nothing in the governor's budget to fund this need, and I would have assumed that if DHS was seeking additional funds for legal representation, that would have been included in the governor's budget. So I agree. I wish I had been more involved earlier in this process, but I also wasn't given information to indicate that the product we're looking at now was in the works. I wasn't provided the amendments until the day before the public hearing. That didn't give us a lot of time to respond to them. And of course, the big issue and the reason for greater concern today is seeing the fiscal impact, which was provided moments before the work session in the previous committee, and having time to absorb that and consider what that amount of money could provide if it were spent elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the challenge with this bill, we actually did work a lot on it. Unfortunately, I didn't hear from Youth Rights and Justice until walking into the work session that day. I think Angie mentioned you might raise some concerns. Certainly, we would have provided you with the amendments if we had known you were interested in the bill, either myself or the committee administrator. But the reason that we worked on the bill is that without legislation extending the sunset, that sunset cannot continue. We have courts that are saying that they won't hear these cases. If the bill doesn't pass, the fiscal will be much bigger, because rather than the phase-in, we will immediately have to have representation in all of the counties across the state. And there was some concern about the capacity to staff up that quickly. I'm interested in the concerns that you're raising. I just really wish that they had been raised at an earlier time when the work group was working, so that we could have included you in those many, many meetings and conversations earlier on.
So let me just, I guess, put on the record here. This is kind of an ongoing, as most people know that have been following this issue. We did, in fact, give the authority for the agency to be able to go in and represent as their agency, with the understanding that we knew what the impact was going to be in trying to ramp up as quickly as Senator Gelser has said, to have attorneys actually appearing on behalf of DHS. It seems to me that we're still facing that same dilemma as we were then. It's unfortunate, you know, from my perspective, this wasn't worked during the interim in a much greater way of determining what are the various alternatives and issues. And Mark, what you brought up are some food for thought for us to be considering as to ensuring that we have the representation that's necessary. I know for many people, looking at what the estimated cost for per hour for the Attorney General's office to be doing the work is going to raise some eyebrows. There's just no doubt about that when you consider, as you mentioned, what is actually paid to individuals that are under contract for the different components in this. But it is very important, as Senator Gelser said, from the chair's perspective, that the bill moves forward, because at this point, I think it's essential that we have a transition that's going to be smoother than what we would have if we didn't have it. And so with that, I expect that this bill, on its way to Ways and Means, will probably have a little bit more work and understanding, and I would expect that we're going to see ongoing detailed work during the interim and trying to expedite what is going to be the best course for this state to ensure that the children do have representation, and that representation is beyond adequate, that can actually go in there and do the work that needs to be done and know all the issues. And this is not to take away from those who are working for DHS going into the court, but at the same time, without that legal training, I think there are pitfalls that could actually occur, and that's one of the concerns I have. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will agree. The bill that's in the House is a very important bill. I consider it all part of the same package personally, and because that bill does deal with representation for the kids and parents at the initial hearing. And it's something we've been after for a long time and haven't been able to get very far with it. I consider this to be a companion. I would say, Mr. Chair, that when this does go to Ways and Means, that they take a hard look at the numbers and see if they're, if the numbers are appropriate. But that's the job of the Ways and Means Committee. But I also want to say that we have a new governor, and this is an issue she is very, very interested in. So I think that's going to be helpful moving forward. In fact, I would say, Mr. Chair, on the day she was sworn in, she asked me about this package at that point in time. So, you know, is this perfect? No, but we need to do this. And you know, we can't just focus on one side of this. It's the ultimate goal here is to have adequate legal representation for all parties at all times. That's the goal, and hopefully this is going to help move us in that direction.
All right, thank you. Any other comments? All right, so let's see where we're at. I think we need to go with the motions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, Senator Cruz, why don't you start?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 222A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the committee, Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 222A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and requests a subsequent referral of the bill to the Ways and Means based on the fiscal that we've received. Any discussion? Any objection? No, not hearing any, so ordered. And it will be noted for the record that the letter to the President's office has been signed requesting that referral to Ways and Means. Since it will be going to Ways and Means, there is no need to have a carrier, and so we'll close that work session on Senate Bill 222A, and we'll open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 468A.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 46A comes to you from the Senate Workforce Committee. Again, another one that was heard in a different committee and sent over to us for further review. This comes to you from Senator Dembrough and Senator Przonski. It allows the Commissioner Boley to file a warrant with the county clerk lien record. A properly served and notice warrant acts as a judgment against the debtor, who then may be subject to liens and garnishment. In order to issue the warrant, the judgment must be entered, the time for filing the notice of appeal expired, and the warrant must reflect the principal amount of the debt, any added interest, and other costs. A recent survey of Boley cases shows over $30 million in unsatisfied judgments from wage and hour violations are out there. This bill is ready to move today, should you choose to do that.
All right, thank you. Let's see, we have Paloma Sparks here for the Bureau. Paloma, once you come forward, while she's coming up, let me ask, is there anyone else who will want to testify on Senate Bill 468A? Ms. Paloma?
Good morning, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 468A. Amendments were worked on this bill in the Senate Workforce Committee. We worked with business advocates to clarify that we would not be going forward with any garnishments until all the time period that a final order had been submitted and that the time period for filing a notice of intent to appeal had passed. This is a really important tool in making sure that we are collecting funds, particularly wages due to workers. As Chana noted, a recent survey of our wage and hour final judgments revealed that there were over 30 million in unsatisfied judgments. Most of that is for wages due to workers. When we get a complaint, the Bureau investigates and does a complex and in-depth investigation into whether or not there's sufficient evidence to support going forward with the case. We encourage all parties, if we find that there's sufficient evidence, encourage all parties to settle. If a settlement is not reached, then we go forward with an administrative hearing. At that point, a final order is entered if the administrative law judge and the commissioner agree that there was a violation that occurred. This is to make sure that we can collect on those judgments once we have a final order in place.
All right. Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
Yes, I have the privilege of being on the Workforce Committee hearing this bill, and I was under the impression that this was to do with wage and hour, but I'm looking at it a little more closely, and maybe you can clarify for me. Would this be for any debt owed or that Bowley deems is owed to the agency?
This would, Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, this would be where there's been a final order. Most of the issue will be in wage and hour laws. That's where we find there's a greater need to be able to collect, but it would apply to any debts that that there has been a final order and the time period for a notice to appeal has passed.
Okay. I guess I'd feel more comfortable with this bill, even though I did vote yes in that committee, because I think there are a lot of situations where fines are levied against a small business that are pretty hefty, and I don't know that they can necessarily afford court, but I would feel more comfortable if we just focused on the wage issue alone. Right. Since you're saying that is where it's mostly focused, I would definitely support it if that's the case. Would you be open to that?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I'd have to have some additional conversations, but that is the bulk of what we're trying to address right now.
So let me just make certain, for the record, my understanding is that someone has brought up on, let's say, the allegation of something going wrong, either wage payments or whatever else Bowley has jurisdiction over. They go through a hearing, administrative hearing process, and this process that we're talking about that's captured here for the warrant would not be available until you have a final order from the agency, and then after the set time for an individual to appeal that to a court has passed. Is that correct?
Senator, Chair Przanski, that's correct.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. Let me ask again if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 468A. Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 468A. Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 468A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 468A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussions?
Mr. Chair, if I could, Senator Thatcher brought up what I think is a good point. I personally would like to be able to look at that a little more, so I, just to be safe, I'm going to be a very soft no at this point in time until I have a chance to fully explore that issue.
Okay. Senator Thatcher?
Yeah, I expressed my concerns. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Well, okay. We're going to go ahead and call for the vote. And so besides Senator Cruz, is there anyone else in objection to the bill as it's been presented?
Like I said, Ms. Chair, it's a very soft no. I hadn't thought about that aspect. I just want to explain.
No, I understand. I fully appreciate that. So the motion carries. And it looks like I'm going to ask Senator Dimbro to be the primary carrier. The chair will be a backup carrier if he's not available. And that closes that work session. So I believe that takes care of the work that we had scheduled for today. And so tomorrow we're back up at 8. Please remember the next week or so, next couple of weeks, I'm going to say, we'll be needing to get that extra 30 minutes in just to stay on top of our workload. So with that, thank you very much. We're adjourned for the day.
Certainly one.
We're adjourned for the day.